You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. So we recently did a program on Matt Richtel's book, An Elegant Defense, which is about the human immune system. And one of the points of the book is that our society has gone so far in the pursuit of hygiene and cleanliness that we are not getting the beneficial bacteria and microbes that we need, and we're not stimulating our immune systems enough, so they start attacking our own bodies. That is called the hygiene hypothesis, and it's an important lesson for our time. But today's author, David K. Randall, gives us a hint of how we got to this point. We're going to be talking about the plague, bubonic plague, and the problem of filthy rat-infested cities that led to the spread of all kinds of diseases, and the massive public health campaigns that cleaned them up. Stay with us, we'll be back in just a half a minute. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy to welcome David K. Randall. He's a reporter at Reuters, and he's author of several books. The newest one is Black Death at the Golden Gate, The Race to Save America from the Bubonic Plague. Welcome, David.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
This is such an interesting book, not only because we have plague flaring up from time to time in the state of New Mexico, and we can maybe talk about that a little bit later, but it's a book about science and medicine as they confront a horrible illness, but it's also about people and politics and how incredibly important personalities are and relationships if you want to actually get anything done in science and medicine. The book starts at the very end of the 19th century when there was an outbreak of bubonic plague in Hawaii and then in San Francisco. Describe that to us. What did it look like? Who got hit by it?
So most people know about the bubonic plague because they hear, you know, from middle school or high school, you know, when plague decimated Europe in the 1300s and killed half of the population.
Right.
Most people don't realize that plague never really went away. There was another global outbreak that began in the 1870s in Asia, and it killed 10 million people in China, killed another 5 million people in India, and then it started spreading across the world. So this was the dawn of the steamship age. This was the first time that, you know, people and goods and the diseases they were carrying could cross the Pacific quickly. So plague reached Honolulu in 1899, and then it reached North America for the first time in history in 1900 when it reached San Francisco. And, you know, plague is one of the most terrifying diseases in history, and it's a very fast-acting disease, which is probably why, you know, it's so terrifying. So bubonic plague gets its name from if you contract the disease, you have what's called a bubo, which is a swollen lymph node that fills with blood. It's either in your groin or your armpit. And then you have a high fever, you have delusions, you lose control over your body. And then most people die within 48 to 72 hours. The disease can then also become what's called pneumatic plague, which is it gets into your lungs. And then it's spread just by coughing. And this is what happened in Europe. And this is also what briefly happened in San Francisco. So this was a disease where, you know, there was no medicine that could treat it at the time. There were no vaccines. We still don't have a vaccine for plague. So doctors were really struggling and under an incredibly tight window to find a way to prevent this disease from spreading before millions of people's lives were at risk in the U.S.
It was very much present in Chinatown in San Francisco. And one of the crazy sort of shocking things about, I mean, we shouldn't be shocked at anything these days, but about this story is the role of racism in how the disease was addressed. There was so much prejudice against Chinese people that basically their race was blamed for the plague. And this went deep into San Francisco society. It wasn't just some small number of racist people. It was doctors, public health officials, newspaper editors, all in one way or another, factoring race into this. Give us a sort of picture of what that looked like.
So race was at the forefront of almost every conversation in San Francisco and California at the time. It was a level of anti-Asian bigotry and racism that's hard to fathom today. The mayor of San Francisco at the time was a man named James Fallon. He became a U.S. senator from California, and he eventually ran on a campaign slogan that literally said, "Keep California white." And he won. California at the time was still pretty young in many ways. This was, 1900. California had been a state for 50 years or so. There were still literal gold miners, 49ers who were walking around the streets of San Francisco. But at the same time, it was the first time California and San Francisco were kind of hitting middle age. There was no longer a time where people could come and just look for gold and suddenly have wealth beyond their wildest dreams. It was the first time that, white men couldn't get jobs easily. So they were looking for someone to blame. And the target were Chinese immigrants. Chinese immigrants came to California. The first known Chinese immigrants came during the gold rush. And then thousands more came to build the Transcontinental Railroad. It was an incredibly difficult job, incredibly dangerous job that many white men would not take. And then Chinese immigrants centered in Chinatowns in places like San Francisco and Los Angeles. Chinatown in San Francisco is right in the heart of the city. If you've been there, it's 12 blocks right in the middle of downtown. It's kind of the nicest location-wise in the city. But the reason why many Chinese lived in such small areas was that, there was no way for many of them to become citizens. The first anti-immigration acts in the U.S. history were targeted toward the Chinese. And the landlords of Chinatown buildings were able to charge extremely high rents and not have to do anything. People lived in squalor. And, one thing I discovered was that James Fallon, the mayor who later became such a strong racist, he was one of these landlords in Chinatown who were making money hand over fist by renting to a population that he publicly despised. So Chinese immigrants had an incredibly difficult job. They had to take the jobs that nobody else, just like immigrants anywhere, would take the jobs that nobody else would take. So when you walked around in Chinatown at the turn of the century, it really felt like you were on the other side of the world. All the signs were in Chinese. Many men would walk with long ponytails called queues, which were required if they ever wanted to return to China, which many did. So for many people, it was thought of as just a temporary stay in California. But for many people, they also realized that the riches they were hoping to make never materialized. So they had pretty grim lives.
And meanwhile, they were disproportionately hit by plague. Do we know why that was?
So plague came from Asia. And it came to Honolulu and Chinatown in Honolulu. And then it likely came through a person or rats and fleas on a ship from Honolulu to San Francisco. So then the disease most likely came that way and went into the Chinese community there. At the time, doctors didn't know how plague was spread. It was through this that they demonstrated for the first time that it's fleas on rats that spread the disease. But at the time, there was this idea that maybe it was just somehow filth itself. So when the disease was first discovered in Chinatown, it almost seemed to confirm all the racist stereotypes that here's this dirty area, and because it's so dirty, it has this terrifying disease. And therefore, these are quote-unquote dirty people that we need to take this area of Chinatown back and expel all the Chinese away from the U.S.
At a certain point, health inspectors were sent from house to house in Chinatown, and they didn't always do what they were supposed to do. In fact, often they did the opposite, robbery, abuse, even rape, and therefore completely undermined their own efforts toward public health.
Exactly. So the big fight at this time really was over, it was not only racism, but it was also the legitimacy of science. That public health inspectors at the time in many ways didn't believe in science as we see it now. The idea going up to the highest levels, the Surgeon General even, didn't believe that white people, people with European ancestry, could somehow get plague. They thought that if essentially, if your ancestors survived plague in Europe in the 1300s, you have immunity to it now, which wasn't true. So there was this mistaken belief that there was almost an invincibility field around the rest of the city, which wasn't true. And then at the same time, when plague was first identified, there was a quarantine for less than 24 hours, and then the city pulled it because they didn't want to admit the danger of plague or they didn't want to hit the city's economy. So the main doctor in charge was this man by the name of Joseph Kenyon. He was a public health officer, U.S. federal public health officer, who was in San Francisco not because of plague, but almost in spite of it. He was, you know, known as the most brilliant doctor in the country. He had studied plague more than anybody else. But he was in San Francisco because he had this talent at making people hate him, essentially. And the U.S. Surgeon General expelled him to San Francisco because he didn't want him to threaten him and his job. So Kenyon was there, and he knew how dangerous plague could be. And he was incredibly aggressive to try to stop it, to try to contain it as much as possible. And it seemed like everything he was doing just made the situation worse.
Well, Kenyon's story is such an interesting object lesson in the reality that it's not enough to be smart or brilliant or to be right or to have science on your side. You actually have to have people skills, and he didn't.
Exactly. He really represented the hard side of science, you know, epidemiology, of trying to discover and create a medicine or vaccine to stop a disease, trying to track where it's going to go next. He really was laboratory science personified. And this was an era where laboratory science really wasn't accepted yet. This was really the generation where, you know, someone was considered a doctor for a long time simply because they were fast with a knife when maybe pain medication wasn't available. And it was really within this lifetime that science became something that people in, you know, white lab coats and hospitals and x-rays and microscopes, that's something that they do. So he really was at the forefront of this, but he also showed the limitations of it, that he knew what was happening, and he knew more than anyone else how dangerous this could be, but no one believed him. And he had this talent at making people not only dislike him, but try to actively undo what he was doing. So eventually a state senator in Sacramento stands on the Senate floor and says that Kenyon should be hanged for what he was doing.
I have to say, I mean, reading it, you know, one's heart kind of goes out to Kenyon because he was in many ways ahead of his time. I mean, now we don't question, you know, men with microscopes as being suspect. I mean, you know, most of us really understand that science has done incredible work, both curing and preventing disease. But this was that transitional time where, I mean, even the idea of microbes was not understood by everybody.
Exactly. This was really the time where, you know, people started understanding that germs and bacteria cause disease. Kenyon was one of the first bacteriologists in the country. For a long time, microscopes were thought of as something just as, you know, idle toys for wealthy people to play around with. There was no idea that this could be so important to science. And Kenyon went through this because, you know, he was motivated in many ways because he had personal pain behind it. One of his children died of diphtheria, which was at the time one of the most deadly childhood diseases. And it briefly made Kenyon not want to be a doctor anymore. But then he discovered that, you know, science could also be a way out. He could put that pain to good use. So he studied in Germany with some of the most important people in terms of creating this new era of science. And he sat there and watched kids with diphtheria in hospitals in Germany receive what were at the time experimental medicines and watched them recover as almost as if by magic. So in the book, I describe it as like as if Prometheus came back and stole another secret of the gods. So Kenyon, in many ways, he's, even though everybody hated him, in many ways, he is a sympathetic character because he was right. He knew what was going to happen, but he had these fatal flaws. And one of his big flaws was his personality. He knew he was right, and he couldn't find a way around that frustration that other people wouldn't believe him. And at the same time, he was undone in some ways by his own aggressiveness. The Chinese and Chinatown started calling him the wolf doctor because he was so aggressive. So they started hiding bodies from him, you know, hiding the victims. So people kept on telling Kenyon, you're telling me that there's an outbreak of plague here. So where's the living victim? And he could only find, you know, essentially dead bodies that had been dumped in different places. And he could never present a living patient or living victim of the disease. So he, you know, it was easy to say, how believable are you really?
So let's talk about the next guy, Rupert Blue. He was the replacement for Joseph Kenyon as the public health officer of San Francisco. And he was somebody who, at first glance, seemed to be lacking in the, certainly in the scientific laboratory brilliance of his predecessor. But he wound up being so much better at his job because of a combination of people skills and scientific understanding, and also a relative lack of racial prejudice, which allowed him to actually see more clearly what was going on. I mean, that's something that has to be mentioned about Kenyon, was that he had, even with his, you know, being a man of science, he still had this racial prejudice clouding his ability to see, and Rupert Blue, not so much.
Yeah, exactly. So Kenyon was, you know, a brilliant scientist, but he could never really look past the outer shell of race. Rupert Blue, he was never thought of as a genius. You know, he barely graduated med school, and he was kind of thought of as kind of lazy. But what he did have going for him was, you know, he had a strong talent of affability. He knew how to get people to like him. And it wasn't in a disingenuous way. He really did seem to care about other people as well. Whereas Kenyon, he always stayed in his laboratory on Angel Island. So, if you've been to San Francisco, Angel Island is actually the biggest island in the bay. If you're going over the Golden Gate Bridge heading north, it's the big island on the right. So Kenyon stayed there in his laboratory, and he was really, you know, physically isolated from the community he was trying to help. Blue, he decided to open up an office in Chinatown itself. He did things that were considered radical at the time. He hired Chinese translators and treated them as if they were full members of his staff. And, you know, lo and behold, they began to trust him. And they started showing him, you know, I can direct you to where a living victim is. I can show you where more of the bodies are. Kenyon really represented the hard side of science. Blue represented the softer side of science, which is just as important, which is persuasion, of getting people to have trust in you and to take the steps then to protect not only themselves, but to protect others as well.
Was he the discoverer, or how did they finally make the connection to rats and fleas?
So Blue recognized that something was spreading the disease, and it was slowly spreading outside of Chinatown itself. And he was trying to discover how it was. He was looking at different victims and trying to trace their movements in the days before they died. And there was nothing that was connecting them. And he realized that it must be something that he couldn't see. There was literature at the time suggesting that it was the fleas that spread plague and not just filth or not rats themselves. You know, it's the first time this was ever demonstrated in a real-world situation. He started targeting rats themselves. So he began what became the largest rat eradication program in the country's history. And he did this in many ways. You know, he did certain things like leaving poison around and the traditional ways of targeting rats. But more importantly, he worked to get the city on his side so that people were taking actions themselves. You know, he spoke to anybody who would listen to him. You know, he spoke before women's groups. He spoke before longshoremen. He spoke before business titans. And he was telling them that the noblest work you could do would be to kill a rat, because rats are the host of fleas, and this is what's spreading disease. So by the end of the outbreak, they killed something like 2 million rats in San Francisco, which was something like five times the city's human population. And not only did it starve the disease of new victims, but it also created a revolution in terms of how we see cities. You know, a lot of the things we think of as just common sense public sanitation for cities, like street sweeping and having cement sidewalks instead of wooden ones so rats can't burrow underneath, to rat-proofing trash cans. These are all things that Blue pioneered. And it was because of things like this, and, you know, then also the development of things like antibiotics and medicine and other medicines, that the average lifespan of an American extended by about 30 years in the 20th century. So not only was life cleaner, but life was a lot longer. So then, therefore, you have a different kind of value of life and a different meaning if it's going to be a much longer affair.
Yeah, that's a really huge shift. And I mean, there's a number of cultural and way of life shifts in what you're saying. I mean, one of them is you paint this picture of post-gold rush San Francisco that, as you said, so dirty and so much greed, even on the part of doctors. And that was another thing that was changing, was like ethical codes for doctors, which hadn't existed. It was a different way of even learning medicine. It was more like a trade. So much corruption. And then it's like, okay, we've got to get rid of rats. Everybody has to help. This is not a job for the authorities. It's a job for citizens. And that really pulled people together in a way that made that city more cohesive and less, I don't know if you want to use the word selfish, but it really made a huge cultural change.
Exactly. So San Francisco really was a place where the ethos was, you know, every person for himself. And that was a legacy of the gold rush. You know, people came to San Francisco to search for gold, not because they thought they were a better gold miner than anybody else. They were just hoping that they were going to be lucky. You know, there's no real skill at the time of panning for gold. You just kind of lucked out or not. So there was this idea that you never wanted to have anything in the way of government or laws that would get in your way of being lucky. So there was no sense of public responsibility. San Francisco, even as it grew, its spending on public health declined. So you had this bustling city that called itself the Paris of the West with the festering problems of a boomtown. And this was the first time where, you know, San Francisco and other places too, you know, blue also combated a plague outbreak in New Orleans and Los Angeles, and he helped prevent plague from reaching New York and Philadelphia. This was the first time that, you know, people started realizing that we have a responsibility to each other and, you know, this community action that can help save all of us. And we have to band together against this disease that none of us can control on our own.
In 1906, San Francisco experienced a massive earthquake. And it's another story, among other things, of the city's racism. They gave food to European Americans, not Asian Americans or Asians. But how did the earthquake affect the fight against the plague?
So blue had helped contain the disease and essentially eradicate it from Chinatown itself before the earthquake. After the earthquake, then, you know, the rats started spreading to different areas of the city. So suddenly you had it not just in, you know, predominantly Asian neighborhood, you had it in Italian neighborhoods, every race and every group, every community in the city itself. And it suddenly was the nightmare scenario that Ken Yun always envisioned. So, you know, San Francisco is a very geographically diverse city as well. You have everything from beaches to forests to really urban business districts to horse stables. And suddenly the disease was spreading in all of them at once. And there were cases of the pneumatic form of the disease, which was spread just by coughing. You didn't even need the rats anymore. So blue had to come back to the city, and he had to fight, you know, every public health officer's worst nightmare. I was able to find one of blue's great-great-nephews, maybe his great-great-great-nephews. But he had a bunch of letters that he saved from blue. It was interesting to see in newspapers at the time, blue, you know, giving public proclamations that, you know, we're going to be able to contain this. You don't need to panic, that kind of thing. And then writing letters to his sisters that night saying, you know, this is the scariest thing I've ever seen. I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to contain this. And if it spreads outside of San Francisco, all of California will need to be quarantined.
It's interesting reading about this guy, Rupert Blue, who eventually became the Surgeon General of the United States, because he was so, I mean, he was really good at what he did, but he was also insecure and self-effacing. And every success he had, he sort of saw the dark side. It's like, okay, there's one more day where we didn't have plague, but what about tomorrow?
Exactly. So he, you know, he came from a big family in the South, and one of his older brothers was kind of considered the family favorite, and he became a war hero. He was a war hero of the Spanish-American War. a battleship was eventually named after him. And Rupert, as a kid, that kind of always made him slink back. And then he, you know, started realizing, you know, his older brother's name was Victor. Perhaps Victor's, you know, he's a soldier. Perhaps his mission in life is to hurt people. Then perhaps my mission in life is to heal them. So that's how he really, you know, had that idea and personality. And he also always knew how bad it could get. He was not one to say, to declare victory quickly. He knew that plague could be something that could ransack the city for a generation if he didn't act. And you know, eventually he became the U.S. Surgeon General. He also got to see that all the things that helped in combating a very localized problem like plague, they didn't really help him when it came to the 1918 flu outbreak. So thousands of people died under his watch because he was a little bit too slow to act and he was a little too willing to let other people take some of the, not the responsibility, but, you know, hear them all out and not act as perhaps as decisively as he should have. He lost his job as the Surgeon General. He was demoted. But one thing I think was really telling about his personality is that he didn't quit. You know, many people, when they're head of an organization and they're demoted, they leave. He never left. He took a lower ranking job and he did it without complaint. And then later in his life, when there was another outbreak of plague in Los Angeles in 1924, he was essentially called off the sidelines and he had to save the country again. And he did it without making himself a hero or without requesting the attention of a hero.
Another thing you said a moment ago, which I think was really interesting, is that this whole era of plague and the beginning of science and the understanding of microbial science, which eventually led to antibiotics and lots of other forms of treatment, but that whole rise in understanding ushered in a period in which, as you said, many of us kind of expect that we are probably going to have a long and relatively healthy life. But that's so recent, and your book really reminds us of what an incredible privilege that is.
Yeah, one thing I thought was so interesting about this era was that it really was the doorstep of the modern age. This really was the generation where a lot of the medicine that we take for granted and a lot of the science we take for granted was discovered. And you realize it wasn't just, oh, look how, you know, lucky we were that suddenly we discovered this. It was really individuals who were doing things because of the individual things in their lives. You know, Ken Yun had the devastating experience of losing a young child. Blue had the hard experience of always feeling that he was, you know, kind of unloved and he needed a way to make his name in the world and have a sense of purpose. And you realize that all of these things that we take for granted are because of individual people and because of individual circumstances, and they can go away too. You know, you only have to see things like the measles outbreak or other things where, you know, cities are not investing as much in public sanitation and hygiene, and these diseases come back. You know, we have the same bodies that we did 100 or 1,000 years ago, so we're still vulnerable to the same things as well.
Where are we in terms of plague today? I mean, one of the things you mentioned is that there still is no vaccine. It does pop up in New Mexico from time to time. A couple of years ago, there were some people who got plague, although there are treatments now. But then there's the fear that some of those treatments can develop resistant strains. What's the status of plague in the U.S. and worldwide?
So about 10 people on average get plague each year in the U.S. And that number could rise because, you know, it's a disease that really, you know, obviously comes from contact with rats and fleas. As the climate gets warmer and more people live in cities, the rat population in places like New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Houston is just exploding. You know, global rat population, urban rat populations are up by about 20% over the last 10 years. So more rats lead to more fleas lead to more flea-borne diseases. And you can see this in Los Angeles now. City Hall in Los Angeles is infested with rats, and a worker there came down with typhus, which is another disease you think of as, you know, kind of being a medieval disease, and it's spread by rats. In New York, there are pretty rare and fatal diseases that are spreading, that are contracted by contact with rat urine. So these diseases are not going away. If anything, they're coming back in force, especially as you have homelessness crisis in places like Los Angeles and San Francisco. So you have more people living without shelter and living in closer contact with rats and fleas. There's a greater likelihood of these diseases to come back. Plague can be treated by antibiotics, but one of the dangers, not only of the fact that, you know, diseases can become resistant to antibiotics, is that it's also an incredibly fast disease. You know, it's 48 to 72 hours. So if you're somebody who doesn't have access to a doctor, or if your doctor doesn't know the signs to look for, then that's not a very long window to receive treatment before it's too late. And one of the issues, too, is that, you know, in places like New Mexico, where it's a known risk factor, vets know to look for plague. Because, you know, a vet is most likely going to be the middle man between the first one to spot the disease, essentially, because maybe a dog goes into an area where there's plague-infected fleas, and then the dog gets sick, and then the vet can see those signs. As plague spreads into areas where it's not common now, vets and other doctors aren't trained to be on the lookout for it. So the window gets even smaller in which somebody needs to act.
What are some of the lessons for our own time that we can take from this period of 100 years ago? And I'm thinking, I mean, part of what this reminded me of the parts about how science was politicized. I mean, the governor of California went very strongly against all the public health realities to deny that there even was plague in California for economic reasons. They didn't want to have ships, you know, not come into the harbor, or they didn't want to have quarantines for reasons of commerce and tourism and so on. But I was also thinking of the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s and how science was so politicized at that time. Mm. Not as much racism as homophobia, but still prejudice in science.
And that's an issue that's not going away. There's a very strong sense of science denialism. In this country and others too, I mean, you see it everything with people not wanting to take vaccines when they've been proven that they've been safe, to things like climate change now. Scientists are pretty clear, and all the data show that the climate is changing, and that's going to have some pretty serious ramifications over the next 20 to 30 years. And it's an issue that's been politicized, when it's also an issue that it really will take collective action to prevent pretty severe weather patterns that could completely change what we consider normal life now.
What does this era have to teach us about vaccines? I mean, there are people now, as has been in the news so much, who refuse to vaccinate their children.
So you're seeing now that, you know, there's over 1,000 cases of measles in the U.S. This was the disease that was considered completely eradicated from the country less than 15, 20 years ago. You saw some of this in the plague outbreak, too, that they had what was called the Hafkeen serum, which it wasn't a true vaccine. It only worked for 2 or 3 years, but it prevented your chance of getting plague by about 40%. It had pretty strong side effects, high fever, and your body would be flush and all of that. But people didn't want to trust it. They thought, why would I ever put that in my body when I don't believe plague is here in the first place? So the big fight for science that continues to this day from the book is really the fight for legitimacy, for people to trust in something that they can't see. One thing I was really struck by was that people at the time didn't trust Ken Yeung, even though he was so brilliant, and despite his personality, is because they couldn't see what he was doing. Something in a microscope is not as readily apparent as, you know, someone bleeding in front of you. So this idea that bacteriology and science and everything else that we now consider medicine seemed really cold at the time. It wasn't the visceral blood and guts of medicine, but before. So I think that getting over that hump of getting people to trust in something they can't see, even though it's been proven, is still a battle that we're fighting.
One of the things that I was thinking about when, you know, reading about rat eradication, rats in cities are what people have used the words pests and vermin, and it's just not a good idea to have swarms of rats in cities for the exact reasons of disease. But there were also other parts of the story, the California story, where other animals like squirrels were being shot in great numbers because of plague. And that does lead to the question of when you've got a disease that's spreading outside of a city and you start to use pest eradication techniques on, for lack of a better word, legitimate members of the ecosystem and necessary creatures, what happens then? What kind of unwanted ecosystem side effects are put into place?
So that's actually one of the big issues with trying to focus on disease control now. So California has ground squirrels. Fleas will jump from a rat to a ground squirrel with no problem. They feed on the same animals and they can be just as happy on that as well. So the idea that you don't want to necessarily kill animals that are just part of the natural ecosystem is one of the reasons why cities have pulled back from rat eradication programs. And also the idea, too, that you don't want to just leak poison out, because what happens if, you know, God forbid, a kid gets close to it or somebody's pet or something else? So it's not as easy as somehow it seems in many ways. It's not just as simple as let's go find all the rats and kill them, because, first of all, rats live in pretty much every place in the world where there's a human settlement, and they're incredibly, they're survivors. They can jump off a four-story building and be fine. A single pair of rats can have 15,000 descendants in a single year. Their teeth are stronger than iron, and they can swim on top of it. So they really survive. So it's not just a question of let's target this part of the environment. To really change that, what will need to happen will be a change in human behavior. You know, can't necessarily change the environment. You have to change what you're doing inside of it. And that, in many ways, is a much more challenging thing to get over than just saying, let's kill a bunch of things.
Any other takeaways from this period in history? Like, how did it make you think differently to write this book?
I think one thing I realized is there's a lot of history that many people just don't know of, because it's not something that, you know, especially on a close call like this, people don't want to remember it. They don't want to, and they don't want to remember how difficult and how different society was in many ways. So, you know, I grew up in California. I lived in LA for a while. I lived in the Bay Area, and I had never heard of any of this. And I didn't know the extent of the racism in California, of the greed and the corruption in California. And it makes you realize that history is not just some nostalgic era when everything was great. In many ways, we've made incredible progress. But, you know, all you have to see is something like the measles outbreak and realize how vulnerable that progress really is.
The book is called Black Death at the Golden Gate, The Race to Save America from the Bubonic Plague by David K. Randall. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Building resilient children, families, and communities through early childhood support and partnerships, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks LANL Foundation for their sponsorship of this program. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.